Welcome to the Lavo Show podcast. Conversations with outstanding human beings whose love has been inspired and transformed by Osho. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and thanks for tuning in. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today is a special episode dedicated to Nirvana. Nirvana was Osho's most intimate disciple and lived in close physical proximity to Osho from 1972 to 1989. We are very fortunate to have Veena on the show today, who was Nirvana's close friend and is happy to tell us a bit about Nirvana. I'm so happy to have Veena on the show, back on the show, and I hope you enjoy it. You can listen to Veena's previous interview in episode 3. Veena, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you, I'm fine.
To start, tell us how you first met Vivek, later known as Nirvana.
It was early 1972 when Osho was still living in Woodlands in Bombay. And he was giving a series of talks at a place called Crossman Maidan. I'm not sure of the Hindi pronunciation. And so I was living in the famous Rex Hotel, which many people will know about, and I went along to this discourse that he was giving. And when I arrived, it was very daunting because there must have been about 300 or 400 Indians, and Ma Taru, the famous Ma Taru, was singing kirtan songs. And the Indians were going a bit crazy, and I was like, oh my God, what have I let myself in for? And then Osho came and sat on the podium, and there were 3 or 4 Western women sitting with him. And I thought, well, I'm not going to do that, you know. So I just stood on the side for a while and was wondering what to do. And then I saw this very exquisite young woman sitting in about the 6th row, on the edge of the crowd, and a Western woman, and I thought, ooh, maybe I can join her. So I went over to her and I said, do you mind if I sit with you, because I feel a bit alone? And she said, oh, me too, yes, please sit down. And that was Nirvana. So that was my first meeting. And after the discourse, we went back to Woodlands together. Woodlands was the apartment that Osho lived in. And I hadn't met her before, even though I had been to a camp, a meditation camp in January in Mount Abu. She wasn't there then. And so in Woodlands, there were 2 bedrooms, and Osho shared 1 bedroom with her sister, and Lakshmi lived in the other bedroom. So Nirvana had a mattress in the living room, which wasn't exactly sort of comfortable or private. And after a few days, it was quite strange. Lakshmi came over and she said, oh, we have found an apartment for you, and Nirvana to stay in, because she knew I was living at this very hippie-ish Rex Hotel. And so apparently somebody had said they were going away for a few months and they had this flat, and if Osho needed it, it could be used. So there Nirvana and I suddenly ended up in this very posh flat with marble floors and marble bathroom and everything. So we lived together there for 3 or 4 weeks. And that was just so beautiful. She was a very reserved person, so we didn't say much. But there was just a very, very good feeling between us. And then suddenly Osho called us in one day and said that he wanted us to go to Mount Abu together. Now, I knew that there was a Mount Abu camp coming up, but that was still about 2 weeks away, and we usually went in a kind of a convoy with people. But no, he wanted us to go up. And I thought, oh my God, going in an Indian train and we have to get the tickets. But fortunately, the tickets were bought for us. And so Nirvana and I got into this train in the ladies' carriage and went first to Ahmedabad and then to the Mount Abu station. And Ma Taru, the famous Ma Taru I've just mentioned, she has said, oh, you have to stay in this ashram in Mount Abu. It's a wonderful place and they'll take care of you. And she gave us a letter of introduction, blah, blah, blah. So we got to the station and we got in a taxi. We showed them this ashram and we went there. And when we were there, there were some Indian monks and that, and they were very taken aback to have these two young girls coming to say they were going to come and live with them. And so they showed us this room, which was just horrendous. It like had a cow dung floor, and it stunk, absolutely stunk. And I went over to the small window, and there was a ditch with raw sewage just flowing through it, just outside of our window. And I looked at Nirvana and she looked at me and I said, no way. But I had an idea, because coming into Mount Abu, I had seen a sign saying Duck Bungalow. And in the old days in India, the English had established duck bungalows all around India. So they knew they had a decent place to stay when they traveled on official business. So I said to Nirvana, come on, let's get our bags, we're going there. So we picked our things up, marched out. We didn't even say goodbye to these very rude monks. And we arrived there and it was absolutely fantastic. This beautiful, beautiful Indian style bungalow with high ceilings and a garden. And the caretaker was just delighted to have us. And we paid a whole 2.5 rupees a night. And he cooked for us and everything. It was absolutely blissful. And we just had a wonderful time exploring Mount Abu until Osho came for the camp.
Okay, brilliant. And obviously I'm aware that that was just the beginning of a lifelong friendship with Nirvana. And also I'm aware that you lived in Osho's house together with Nirvana. And we will, of course, go into the details of Osho's relationship with Nirvana, or Nirvana's relationship with Osho. But for now, let's just say that Nirvana was looking after Osho's daily needs. So can you describe what was Nirvana's job?
I think very few people have any understanding of how delicate or fragile an enlightened person's body is. And Osho's body was very, very fragile. People absolutely didn't realize this. And she, of course, realized it fully and therefore realized the extent of the care that was needed in order to take care of him. So, like, her daily routine was to give him his tea in the morning. That was terribly important. And his medication, because he had a kind of diabetes, not a serious one. And although there was somebody to look out, to take care of cleaning the room, she absolutely organized all his life, you know, his clothes, any medical needs that he had. And then she turned secretary, and all the ashram business was done in the afternoon, between 3 and 5 in the afternoon. And in Poonawan, that's when Lakshmi would come with ashram business and stuff. I just must make it clear that very, very few people ever saw Osho in that private capacity. We just simply never went into his room unless business was to be done. So Nirvana had a team of people supporting her to look after Osho. So, for example, Shunyo was doing the laundry, a very important thing. Amrita was looking after the medical side of it. What's his name? Devagit was doing any dental work that was necessary. My job at that point, I was the only person in the sewing room. I was making his clothes. Any sewing that needed to be done in his room, like the curtains. And I'll tell you a little bit of a funny story later on, I hope I remember. And so her job was actually to look after, you know, to supervise her team in looking after Osho's body, taking care of it. I mean, extreme hygienic circumstances. We weren't... only Shunyo touched a garment after it had been washed when it went into him, so that there was no danger of us spreading any germs, because he caught cold very easily. And then there were the cooks, of course, Mukti, who you know, and I think, I've forgotten what her name was. Yeah. So there was a team of probably about 10 people living in the house who were very dedicated to looking after Osha's body, taking care so that when he needed to go to the discourse, give the discourse, darshan in the evening, the clothes were ready, his shoes were ready, the matching socks, the hats, and then all the photographic sessions and all of that. And Nirvana supervised everything. I mean, she was a managing director as well as a nurse, as well as a companion. And then when the whole energy darshan started and all the mediums, she was in charge of all the mediums. And that was a really big job, because there were a lot of things going on underneath the surface there. And so she dedicated her life 24 hours to taking care of him, not only for himself, but so that he was able to do his work for all of us. And I'm shocked that there was so much jealousy and hatred and bad things said against her, whereas we actually should be down on our knees thanking her for taking such good care of him.
So you mentioned that there was a full team of around 10 people looking after Osho's daily needs and all the rest of the activities. And we also see Osho coming up for discourses on the stage. But I understand that in reality, Osho has a very private life. And most of the time, he was confined to his room. And you mentioned before that Nirvana was perhaps the only one who had access to him. Would you like to tell us a little bit more? Could people, even those living in the house with Osho, go to him? Or was Nirvana the only one that had access to him?
That's very clear. Nirvana was, maybe there were two people who had access to him. Nirvana was number one, and in Pune One, it was Lakshmi, the secretary, who saw him in the afternoon. The people in the house had no access to him whatsoever. In fact, even when he went from his room onto the balcony in Nirvana's room, we were very clear at that time. We were not in the passageway. We were not on the stairway. So we were very, very, very aware of his routine, never, ever, ever, ever to disturb him. But if work needed to be done in the room, like the cleaning, that was done, for example, Narupa did the cleaning. That was done when he was eating, so he was out of the room. I had to go into his room on occasions, mainly to fix the curtains, which were giving us endless problems. But I did that during discourse. If any work needed to be done on his room, it was done during discourse or during darshan, so that he never actually met us. So Nirvana was the only. But if we had questions, yes, we asked Nirvana and she would go in and ask him and come back and give us the answer. But no, when seldom saw him physically. Once or twice I went in just to look at a robe that he was wearing that wasn't fitting properly or something, but that was all. And that was never on any personal basis. That was just purely functional, purely to do with the job. And then Lakshmi would go in between 3 and 5 every day with ashram business, with people's questions that they sent in for the discourse. Then they would be sent to him, and then after that he would look and decide which questions he wanted to do. But otherwise, no personal contact at all. Even the guards, there was the whole samurai story in Pune One. So he always had a guard outside his door, making sure that nobody would ever go in and disturb his silence.
From talking to sannyasins, I got the sense that being in Osho's physical presence was not easy, in the sense that his energy field was so strong that people could not even function properly. So if that's the case, and perhaps you can confirm that out of your own personal experience, so how did Nirvana manage that? How was she able to absorb Osho's energy on a daily basis, yet carry on with her daily duties?
Oh, that's a question I don't think I can answer. I guess it goes back to what we've been discussing about spiritual things. If the more your body is in harmony, the more of the energy that you can take. And I think, you know, she was actually had hit quite a high level and therefore was able to absorb it. I never felt that she was in any way dysfunctional from that, which I know I was. I told you the one occasion when I went in to fix the curtain and the energy in the room just hit me and I collapsed on the floor. And she just calmly went around sort of tidying the newspaper that he'd been reading and the pens and all that, you know, and waited laughing. You know, she was looking at me and laughing until I recovered. And then we could talk about the curtains. But no, she was, in that sense, she was very strong. But I also wonder if that constant absorbing of the energy, especially during the energy darshans, where she was his main medium, and I mean, the energy that he was plowing through her every night to spread to so many other people, may have resulted in her latest illness, may have weakened her body, particularly where she was less protected when we were in Rajneeshpuram and more open to outside energies, which might have weakened her resistance too.
Okay, and you mentioned that something about Nirvana's illness, and obviously we'll talk about that towards the end of the show when we'll mention about Nirvana's death. But for now, I'd love to talk about the relationship between Nirvana and Osho. This relationship is quite mysterious and object of many speculation. Some people say that, you know, Nirvana was the girlfriend of Osho, or the lover, or the caretaker. And we also know that Nirvana had love affairs and boyfriends in her life. So what is your understanding of Nirvana's relationship with Osho?
Probably this is the most important point in our whole talk. As far as I am concerned, from my observation of the two of them together, and this has been confirmed by quite a number of my close friends who were also close to her, Nirvana's function was to keep Osho here on this planet. Now, that may sound a bit strange and esoteric, and I think it is, but Osho had spoken quite often about how fragile the body of an enlightened person is, because once a person becomes enlightened, his connection with the earth and with the planet and with people ends. Basically, he should take off into existence. And he said, but those various masters did everything that they could to remain in the body in order to help other people. So, for example, I remember him expressly talking about a enlightened Indian master who never stopped eating. And he was always wanting food and blah, blah, blah. And one of his disciples said to him one day, he said, this is really terrible. You're an enlightened master. You shouldn't be so attached to food. And the master said, the day I stop eating is the day I die. And this is exactly what happened. He stopped eating and he died. And Osho said it was only the food, the sort of physical eating the food and processing it in his body that kept him related to the earth. And then when he felt it was time for him to go, he left. Most enlightened masters like Ramana and other ones did have wives, did have women to take care of them, because I guess in the whole Taoist, I'm not so into Tantra, but there's the male-female thing, and it's that balance between the male and the female that possibly enable these enlightened masters to stay longer. And I feel very, 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 very strongly that Nirvana was Osho's anchor to this planet. And on a personal level, I don't think it's my business or anybody else's business to know exactly what their relationship was. All I know was that it was almost beyond comprehension. The depth, the strength, the beauty was just almost beyond me. But I'll tell you one example once where I was just completely mind blown watching them. It was just after a discourse, yes. And she always used to go, this was in Chantazu still, there in Punawan, and she always used to go out to the door first of all and wait for him to get out of the way so that he could turn around and namaste. And he used to walk backwards into the door, still namasteing everybody. This time he turned around, just maybe 2 feet from the door, and she was standing in the door, and I was watching, and I saw this energy connection between the hara. It was like from the hara, Dantian in Chinese. It was so strong, and it was like she was kind of almost pulling him backwards. And, you know, they were both smiling and looking into each other's eyes, you know. So to reduce their relationship to something that we can understand, I think is futile. You just have to accept that their relationship was on a completely other plane. Just very recently, Bhagwati sent me a photograph of Osho in Lisbon. And he was leaving to go back to India. And I know Nirvana had to go and get visas and stuff like that. So she couldn't accompany him. And she's kneeling in front of him. And you just have to look at the photograph just to see that relationship between them, how strong, how deep it was. And how much fun it was too. Also, there was a very recent photograph of her holding a camera. The best photographs that have been taken of Osho have been taken by her, you know, because of her love for him and that. But she would also joke about him and sort of roll her eyes up to heaven when he was making impossible demands and things which he did often, you know. And then she could also be very cross with us if we didn't perform exactly as it was needed. But yes, if people could only understand that, all the speculation about girlfriends, boyfriends, whatever, just disappears. It doesn't exist because their relationship was on a plane that I don't think we can even perceive of. And I think that maybe we'll talk about that later, about the death and everything. But I hope that people can just, if they could only understand that, all this other rubbish that is said about her just simply disappears, because this was something that is hard for us to understand and of incredible beauty, incredible value, and her purpose, as I say again, I am absolutely 100% convinced, was to keep him here on the planet for us.
Okay, wonderful. And I hope we can access the picture that you just mentioned and use it for publishing the episode, because sometimes a picture and an image speaks 1,000 words, and perhaps it can give us a sense of what you just described. So I've heard you saying once that Nirvana was a Zen master in her own right. Can you give us an example of that and how she, Nirvana, affected you?
Yes, I mean, there were many, many, many occasions, and I've just had a blank of the second situation. I did write it down. But the first situation happened very, very early, and it was actually possibly my first sort of mini Satori. I call it a mini Satori. It was still back in Woodlands. And, you know, I was just a regular hippie traveling around India. So I was talking about Osho, and she looked at me and she laughed and she said, "Veena, Osho isn't a man, he's just energy. And I just kind of went like into another space immediately. It really was like a sort of mini Satori, and it changed my whole perception of him immediately. And that's true. From then onwards, he was no longer a person, a man. He was an energy that was channeling existence energy as well, directly for us. So that was a very, very, very important thing that she triggered. Oh, yes, now I remember the second one. And I think people will laugh and will be interested in this one, because maybe at the beginning of this year, there was a picture posted on Facebook, and it was shared by quite a lot of people, and people were going, oh, how wonderful, isn't this wonderful? And I looked at it and I thought, if you only knew the story behind it, you would maybe have second thoughts. It was a picture taken in one of the very early Mount Abu camps, maybe even the first one, certainly before he moved to the royal palace or whatever it was. And one morning, he sort of suddenly decided, he used to lead Dynamic personally every morning, and we had sort of live drummers making the music, and he used to also conduct the drummers to make them go more chaotic or something as well. And he announced that morning that he wanted us all to take our clothes off and do it naked. And I kind of went, oh my God. You know, because I had already suffered a lot of sexual harassment from Indian sannyasins and that. And I was really annoyed, actually. I was quite angry. And I didn't take my clothes off. And because I thought, I'm not going to deal with this. Because, for example, I mean, I'm going to get down to the nitty gritty. At this place, there were no toilets. So we had to go and pee in the bushes, you know. And I found Indian men skulking behind the bushes waiting to watch me pee, you know. And there was only one other Western woman, Karuna, I think it was, from Denmark. And so in the end, we always took her boyfriend with us when we wanted to go and have a pee, so that he would chase off the Indian men who were trying to look at us, you know, and they were always groping me, and it was just awful. And I said to Nirvana later on that day, after that discourse, when I didn't take my clothes off to do Dynamic, I just told her why. I said, you know, I'm just so fed up with this constant sexual harassment. I said, I hate these fucking Indians. So she laughed at me and she said, right, go into the middle of the meditation field. And she pointed with her finger. We were sitting on the balcony of Osho's house. She pointed with her finger, go in there and start screaming, I hate you, you fucking Indians. I hate you, you fucking Indians. So I looked at her and I said, okay. And I went into the middle of the field and I just started jumping up and down and shouting, I hate you, you fucking Indians. I hate you, you fucking Indians. And and then I came back to her and she laughed and she kind of nodded her head. But Osho heard about it and he asked her why. And I told him, and she told him what I had said. And and the next morning in the Dynamic, he announced that, no, we shouldn't take our clothes off anymore. This is, we forget about that, you know. And then apparently in the discourse that night, he gave the most blistering discourse to the Indians. The discourses were all in Hindi then, you know, there was just a handful of Westerners, about sexual harassment and their sexual repression and blah, blah, blah. And that was his first blasting Indians about their whole sexual repression and everything. So there was another time she was like a Zen master. And then, like, basically almost like, when I altered the sleeves of his white robe, you know, in the early days he was wearing this white robe and I had inherited I started to sew for him after the previous person left, and she gave me the white robe and she said, make it exactly as it is. So I looked at it and I thought, okay, I'll make it exactly as it is. And then when I was making, I thought, this is cut very badly. I can do a much better job, you know. So, but I didn't. I made it exactly, you know. In those days, like the sleeve here, you know, you can see the sleeve of a man's like t-shirt or something. It was gathered. It was like a little girl's thing because they hadn't cut it properly. So they had to sort of gather the sleeve in to fit the shoulder. And I thought, no, this doesn't look good, you know. Anyway, she said, do it exactly. So I did it exactly, you know. And then after a few weeks when I was got a bit more confidence, I thought, I'm going to try. And so I made one robe and I recut the sleeves completely and made them fit nicely like your t-shirt is, you know, and made it fit. She was furious with me. She said, I told you to do it exactly. And I said, yes, I know, but it doesn't look so good. You know, maybe wouldn't you just try and go and try it on? And she was really cross with me. You know, she said, you listen to me when I say you do it exactly. So I said, okay. She took the robe in and put it on. And I was sitting there sort of biting my fingernails, wondering what the next Zen hit I was going to get. I actually came out with a handful of robes, you know, about 8 of them, and she threw them all over me and she said, right, do them all like this by tomorrow. I was like, what? But anyway, so yeah, it was like little things like that every day where I was constantly made aware by her of how much I needed to be aware and how much I needed to surrender to her, and then also how much sometimes I could stand up for myself as well. So I can't think of any other exact thing at the moment. Time-wise, she was an absolute stickler for punctuality. You know, 1 minute late was not good enough. It had to be on time all the time.
Well, thank you so much for this beautiful anecdote of your friendship and life with Nirvana. So let's move on and talk about her tragic departure from the body. So Nirvana left her body prematurely at the age of 42. It must have been a very painful day in your life to lose your beloved friend. What can you recall about the tragic event that you would like to share with us today?
Yes, it was very traumatic. I had watched Nirvana going downhill for a considerable time, and I have spoken about her illness, so I won't repeat it, but I said something that has been published in OSHA News. So if you want to look at details, you can go there and get those details. I was visiting her every day or every second day. She had been moved to Krishna House because it was felt that she was no longer able to take care of Osho in the way that he needed, particularly as his health was going down. And I often wonder still to this day, if her health had been taken care of, would he have managed to stay around longer? But because their decline was parallel, they went down together. And I wonder if that was because she was so ill. So the occasion was, I was running creative arts at the time, the Department of the Multiversity, and because I was no longer part of the team looking after Osho's body, I wasn't living in the house anymore. So I had the day off. In those days, we had days off, you know. And so the day before, I had a day off and I stayed at home when I was down by the river. I had a room in one of the ashram places down by the river. And the day before that, I was very, very, very busy trying to get some performance off the ground. I don't know what it was. And so I hadn't actually been to see her for 3 days. I'm not sure about Guyane. Guyane and I were her constant visitors. Otherwise, there was not many other people except one person who took her food. I was away for the day because in my room, but I came for the discourse in the evening, of course. And in those days, I was one of a team of 6 or 9 women who opened the doors at the back of the podium for Osho. And I was in what I mentally termed to myself the hot seat. And that was, I was opening the door on the, as he went into the podium on the right-hand side. And why it was particularly a potent place was after he had namaste'd everybody from the podium, then he turned round and he walked down this little passage to the door. And at that point, there was just you and him, me and him, you know. So it was very strong, you know. He'd just sort of been channeling all this energy to put out to everybody, and it was still coming. And that's when, yeah, it was quite hard sometimes to stand up, you know. But this particular evening, I was standing at the door as the car pulled up, and as he got out of the car, I was completely stunned. All I can say was stunned. A strength of such existential sorrow that I could hardly conceive of it. I couldn't even put a name to it. I just didn't know what it was as Osho walked in. And he walked past me without looking. Usually he'd namaste to each one of us and smile or something. And he didn't. He walked straight through onto the podium. And I thought, what is going on? What is this? Remember, I'd been away all day. So then I went, then while he was namasteing people, when he turned to namaste the people on the right, we slipped into our seats on the very edge of the where people were sitting, so that we didn't disturb him. And I just sat there the whole time, what's going on? What's going on? I just couldn't fathom, because I had never experienced this feeling around him ever. Around him, there was either a feeling of deep silence, peace, calm, or else joy, laughter, but never just an overpowering sorrow. And so then we went back after the discourse. We'd always slip up quickly and take up our positions at the two doors in the corridor. And as I said, I was in this seat and I was still overwhelmed by this feeling of just such sorrow I could hardly conceive. And then he walked towards me, and for the very first time ever, I could not look him in the eyes. I felt that I was intruding, because never ever have I had the feeling of intruding on Osho, because he was an open book, you know, he wasn't there, you know, so there was no even sense of intruding. But this time I felt by looking at him I was intruding. And so I put my eyes down and I even took one step back, because I felt again I was intruding on his space. And then he just stopped. I had my hands in the namaste position, and he stopped and he put his two hands on either side of my hands. And then he looked at me, but he didn't smile or anything, you know. And then he got in the car and went off. And I was in such shock. I did not know what had happened, and I hadn't spoken to anybody, and I just ran home and I didn't speak to a single person. So I didn't know that Nirvana had died, and I only heard the next morning that she had died the day before. And that was his reaction, was this depth of existential sorrow that I think we can again not even conceive of. So yes, it was very, very, very strong for me, because I knew she was suffering, but I had hoped that, I knew Osho was going to die fairly soon, and that was obvious, and I just hoped that when he died, she would then be able to go and get the treatment that she just really needed. But I sort of knew, that really she couldn't go as long as he was in the body. So I hope that she would last long enough to be able to then get better once he had left and receive hormonal treatment, which was possible and which could have cured her, but things proved to be otherwise. So yes, and I often wonder when he said his comment was her death was untimely, if this is what he meant, that had she been able to stay on longer, she might have been able to recover. So yes, it was a very, very intense and tragic time.
And did you had a chance to ever speak with Osho directly after Nirvana's death?
No, of course not. I mean, by that point, he was so ill that he wasn't even doing ashram business. There was nobody going in, even, you know, in the afternoon. So it was only, I think, Ananda was looking after him and his doctors, Shunya maybe, but otherwise nobody saw him. No, he was, I mean, you know, it was just obvious that he was leaving. Even then, it was obvious that he was leaving. So, no.
And did he say anything publicly, or so long as you know, privately to anyone about Nirvana's death?
Well, you know, there was a little picture, a little sort of shrine made in the ashram, and his words were, her death was untimely. There's that one, and the only other thing was that Ananda said once that he had said she did her best with the body that she got in this life. But I don't think he said anything further than that. It was private, you know. Again, it was that privacy between them, and there's no way that people around would have wanted to intrude on that, you know. Was just accept it, and nothing you can do, and he and her, only they know what was going on. But can I tell you one esoteric thing? I had a lot of sort of little esoteric connections with Nirvana, and but after she died, nothing. And I thought, gosh, this is a bit strange, you know, because I would have somehow thought that I would have felt her or felt her presence somehow. But then 2 years ago, I did the silent retreat at Osho Nisarg. And although I wasn't very comfortable there doing it, I did have a few, what I call again, mini satoris. And I had a very deep meditation one day. And in fact, I didn't even get up. I didn't go to whatever we were supposed to be going to there. And I just sat there in a very deep silence. And suddenly, I had this feeling of Nirvana's presence coming into me. And she was laughing and laughing and laughing like we used to laugh, because we really used to laugh. As well as her being a strict Zen master with a stick, we had so many wonderful times together, and she was always laughing. She was really a bubbly, laughing person. And I just sat there with my eyes closed, and she was just sort of floating around me, and she was just laughing and laughing and laughing, and then she disappeared, and then I felt she was okay.
So, riding this wave of laughter, I'd love to end this episode on this. If you can share with us your happiest moment with Nirvana and how you would like her to be remembered.
it's a difficult one to pick out any one specific incident when we were sort of almost constantly together. And she would always be joking about what Osho had said, and as I said, raising her eyes to the ceiling, and then we'd have to try and figure out what to do. But she always did it with a laugh. And I mean, I do remember one time riding around Rajneeshpuram in her Rolls Royce. You know, Osho gave her a Rolls Royce, which she loved. And she'd never taken a driving lesson. She had no license or anything. But she learned to drive. It was automatic, you know. And I remember one night, we just went out to dinner at the restaurant there, you know. And she said, and then we got in the car, and she turned the car engine on, and she said, oh, you know, this engine is so silent. I don't even know if I've turned the engine on or not, you know. And then she sort of reversed out, and we went back to Lao Tzu house, and she said, you know, she said, isn't this ridiculous? Here I am driving a Rolls Royce on an American ranch, you know. So it was sort of funny things like that. Oh, one time where she really showed her sense of humor, when Osho was in, this was on the ranch, and Osho had started talking again. And so they'd built a new place in Jesus Grove so he could talk to the press and everything. But he demanded a new robe every night, and that meant a hat as well. And those robes took about 3 to 4 days at least to make, plus the hat took a whole day. And if I was making a hat, then I couldn't be sewing. So it was an amazingly stressful time. I mean, we were working like 16 hours a day, you know, trying to get it done. And then it was the one robe we'd had particular problem. And here he was ready to go to Jesus Grove. and we were still sewing, you know, these side wing, we called them the wings. We were still trying to sew them, you know. And she came in, and first she was cross, you know, like, when are you going to be ready? And we said, oh, she said, he's already 10 minutes late. And we said, give us another 10 minutes, you know. So she went out again, and then she came back to see him. And then we were going, we're nearly done, we're nearly done, we're nearly done. And then she just cracked up. She said, if you could just see him, he's sitting naked on the bed with his socks on and his hat on, just waiting for your robe. And we all just absolutely cracked up, you know. And that helped us to sew faster and faster. And he was 20 minutes late for that discourse. But, you know, just little things like that, you know, she was always fun. And then another thing. She wanted me to do something in her room. I'd forgotten what, you know. So she came, I was sewing outside, and she came to call me. She said, come, I want you to do something, you know. And I said, but he's eating on the balcony. You know, her room had a balcony, and he always ate there because he didn't, you know, he was always very sensitive to smell. So she didn't want the smell of food in his room. So he always ate on her balcony. And she said, yes, I know, but I want things to be more relaxed right now. You just come in. Doesn't matter if he hears a tossing. It's quite all right, you know. So I sort of cracked up, and then we sort of decided what needed to be done. I've quite forgotten about it. But she was, you know, she was so informal and like that. Oh, all right. One very precious thing was when I started to make her clothes. Because in early Pune One, somebody had made this dress for her. I don't know. And she used to call it her straight jacket because it was like very unflattering, straight up and down and everything. And then suddenly, I was still editing then. I hadn't started sewing. In fact, this was probably the beginning of how I started to sew. And I saw her walking by, and she was wearing this kind of floppy, voluminous dress, and I thought, oh my God, is she pregnant? She looks terrible in this, you know. And I just thought, this, oh my God, this dress looks awful. This doesn't flatter her because she was so beautiful, you know. And so about a few days later, I got the call to come to the kitchen, and she was standing there in another awful dress. And she said, look, I just got this back from the tailor. Somebody had it made for me, and it looks awful. Can you fix it? Can you make it look better? Because I'd always sewn my own clothes, and I'd sewn my boyfriend's clothes at that time. She knew about that, you know. And I looked at it, and I said, Nirvana, it's horrible. I said, why don't you just let me make you a dress? Oh, no, you can't do that. I said, well, why not? She said, oh, I don't know. So I said, come on, I'm going to make you a dress. And then you see. So I made a dress, and really, it was really beautiful. And she looked so beautiful. So I brought it to her and I said, all right, put it on. And she put it on and she looked in the mirror. She said, oh, I can't wear this. And she started to take it off. And I said, why not? And she said, oh, it's far too beautiful. She said, I just want to stay in the background, you know. And I said, come on. Go and ask Osho. Let him decide what kind of dress you should wear, whether you should wear a dress that makes you look beautiful or not. So she said, I said, go on, go and ask him, you know, and I knew he wasn't asleep or anything. So she went in and she was away for a little while. And then she came back and I said, yes. And she laughed and she said, he said, I looked like an angel. So I said, that means yes. She said, yes. So I made her clothes from then onwards, right until the end. But, you know, she was so sweet. She was just really never egotistical, never wanted to put herself forward, you know, and needed to be persuaded to wear a pretty dress.
Okay, well.
Oh, wait a minute. I haven't said how I want her to be remembered. Sorry, that was the end of your question, wasn't it? I think, first of all, we owe her an incredible thank you for the care and the devotion that she showed for Osho. I am positive without her devotion, he would not have lasted so long or been able to do what he was able to do. She was there for him totally 24 hours a day. And that included waking up every night at 2 o'clock to give him his medicine because he needed to take it at a certain time. So she never had a full night's sleep. And the grace that she did everything with, how she treated us, the team that she worked with who were there. And we made so many mistakes because our awareness was nowhere near as great as hers. And I just want her to be remembered for the exquisite person that she was.
Well, Vina, thank you so much for giving us your point of view, your experience, and giving us the picture of Nirvana through your eyes. It's beautiful to have this account of her story from a person who really loved her. And we want to end on this beautiful, positive note and share something very positive and beautiful about Nirvana. So, well, thank you so much for your contribution, Vina. Okay, enough for today. Okay.
Thank you for listening to the Lavo Show podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, you can show your appreciation by leaving a review on iTunes. Visit lavoshow.com for new episodes, blogs,
and much more.